You're listening to Daydream Nation in care of P. Mosca.
We'll be right back. your source for community information, underreported news, and music from all over the map. We appreciate that. And this is the Wild Clear Water Country. Well, thanks for joining us. We have another Wild Clear Water Country. Sorry, some technical difficulties there for you today. We have a guest in the studio, Om Geckerman.
What's up?
All right. And we're going to be talking about all kinds of things today. We're going to be talking about some news out of Missoula related to forest planning. We're going to talk about a proposal to drive hundreds of motorcycles through roadless areas on the Nez Perce Forest.
Yes, we are.
And, of course, we're going to have our peak of the week, as well as a variety of musical accompaniments. But first, a quick announcement. The University of Idaho Environmental Club and the Palouse Group Sierra Club are sponsoring a showing of the film Source to the Sea, The Columbia River Swim, on January 18th, 7 p.m. in the Gold Room of the Student Union Building. This film is free with a student ID and $5 as a general admission. And just to put this out there...
Say, that's fascinating. Where'd you find that out?
I found that out at the Palouse calendar. What? What is the Palouse calendar?
That looks pretty neat. I don't know. What is it?
Well, it seems to be this fantastic web resource where community groups and local businesses can put their events on an e-calendar from any computer. And if they can also join the Palouse calendar for more services, but this is accessible by folks everywhere, and it's a great way to avoid scheduling conflicts and also to find out what other organizations and local businesses are doing in the community. So check out PalouseCalendar.info. And again, that's Source to the Sea, sponsored by the UI Environmental Club and the Palouse Group Sierra Club. That's showing January the 18th in the Student Union Building, U of I campus. Well, we're going to go to a quick musical break, and we're going to be back to talk about forest planning and some disturbing sentiments out of the regional forester's mouth in Missoula, Montana. Thanks for joining us. That's Velvet Revolver. This is the Wild Clearwater Country. Quick news update for you. We'll start with a proposal by the Idaho Trail Machine Association to host a state ride on 100 miles of trails in the Nez Perce National Forest this coming July. There has been no environmental assessment performed on this proposal. In fact, the Forest Service has applied for grant monies to assist with this proposal, to assist with funding needed for maintenance work on this proposal. And this trail would go right through the Meadow Creek roadless area, which is probably the most important tributary of the Selway River.
Or trails, actually. There's several trails up to possibly 100 miles. They didn't even provide us with enough detail to know exactly where.
They didn't.
No.
And they put a little blurb in the paper and hoped that folks probably wouldn't see it, I would guess.
Ironically, they're saying they really don't need to do any environmental analysis on this. That's really not true. A special use permit like this nature user car requires what's called an environmental assessment. They're trying to exclude it from NEPA. Big problem there.
Big problem.
And they're trying to make travel decisions through the trail maintenance program. Many of these trails are not physically open to motorized vehicles, but they have never closed them, so they go in there and make super highways, and bango, you've got a motorized trail where you didn't before. And that's the kind of deceptive policy that the Forest Service has been following here in the Wild Clearwater Country. And so people ought to be concerned about this and send in a little note. Keep Meadow Creek, the Meadow Creek roadless area, which includes portions of the Upper American and Upper Red River drainages, just little chunks of that, wild and quiet.
Are there currently any rules that exclude motorized use in roadless country in this part of the world, Gary?
No, they're not. They've closed some trails to motorized use, but the real stupid thing is there will be a trail that's closed to motorized use, and it will have a junction with a trail that's open to motorized use. And it's way in the backcountry, and either through lack of signing or whatever, people can get off on the wrong trail. It doesn't make sense. It's a stupid management philosophy. So.
And this idea that the Forest Service is actually applying for a grant to help fund this project, is that typical? Is that unprecedented?
It's not
that
unprecedented.
They would actually assist in a private group's endeavor to...
Well, what they're doing is they are assisting a private group, but they're applying for a grant to the state for tax monies from gasoline for trail maintenance. But to help this private group, to put it under that rubric, I think that's really problematic.
You got to destroy the environment to save it, huh?
That's right.
That's it. So that's a problem, Will, that you're raising there of privatization. It's de facto privatization of the public.
Well, there are channels to do something about this. For those folks out there who might have some hackles raised during this discussion, but you don't have much time at all. January 5th is the cutoff date for comments. Two folks in the Red Ranger District of the Nez Perce National Forest, please check out Friends of the Clearwater's webpage, friendsoftheclearwater.org, and they have on their front page there an action alert describing who to get a hold of through email. And always, as always, our disclaimer, we do not represent Friends of the Clearwater or any other organization on this radio show. We represent ourselves. We just are here to give you the information. Moving on in news, Gary. What do you think? What's next?
Big news. Big news. I think we ought to talk about a new old story. It's an old story because it's something the Bush administration did in 2005, but it's sort of a new story because Nick Rahal, who will be the chairman of the House Energy and Natural Resources Committee, is very concerned about what the Bush administration has done on the national forests. And there's a headline in the Spokesman Review today, Forest Service planning changes causing a stir. And the reason that is the case is that Representative Rahal, he's raised some big concerns some monstrous concerns, actually, about what I would call Forest Service malfeasance. They're trying to do plans without doing any formal environmental analysis going through the National Environmental Policy Act. And that was never intended by Congress when it passed the National Forest Management Act. It said that forest plans would comply with the National Environmental Policy Act. The implication clearly being there would probably be an environmental impact statement and that would involve the public. Well, the Forest Service is involving the public to a certain degree in these plans, but they're not going through the formal NEPA process, and therefore I think they're of questionable, not only questionable legality, but they're of also of questionable integrity and questionable science. And this comes from a story from Perry Bacchus out of the Missoulian. I think he's the one that wrote the letter, wrote the article. And this article, again, was reprinted in the Spokesman from Spokane. And Gail Kimball, and she is the regional forester out of Missoula. So that's all the North Idaho forests, the three of them, Nez Perce, Clearwater, and the Idaho Panhandle National Forests, plus all the forests in Montana fall under her jurisdiction. And what is happening here is, what, at least according to Kimball, she said, she thinks it better reflects what the public wants from its national forests. And amazingly, the public didn't ever say that, but that's what she's claiming. She's claiming that plans don't make any decisions, that they will do analysis at later dates. And in that, she's only telling half the truth. Plans do make broad programmatic decisions, and they do analysis for things like timber sales, or at least they used to. At the same time, the Forest Service, there's a little bit of a catch-22 and some bait and switch going on here, a little shell game, saying they're not. In many instances, they say they're not going to do detailed environmental analysis. They want to do a categorical exclusion like they are in their plans for some timber sales. So you've got a circular argument. On one hand, the forest plan makes, he said, well, the forest plan direction is to do X, and then you get down to it. Therefore, we can do X on the ground because the forest plan said so. And the forest plan says, well, we're going to analyze this when we do X on the ground. And so you've got this circular argument, and that's what the Forest Service has created. I would point out, though, that her contention that forest plans don't make any decisions, site-specific decisions, is patently false. It's not true. And I will use one example that's very important to the wild Clearwater country. There was a decision made about 10 years ago, a little more than that, to protect streams on the national forests and other lands managed in the public interest by federal agencies, mainly Bureau of Land Management. It prohibited, for the most part, although with some exceptions, it prohibited logging within 300 feet of fish-bearing streams that were, you know, had fish in them. And this was, again, to protect it for salmon, steelhead, bull trout, West Slope cutthroat trout. Well, the federal government, because those species were very endangered, came up with this proposal to protect streams. After much internal wrangling, the fishery biologists wanted a much better proposal. And, of course, the timber beasts in the agencies wanted a much worse proposal, and it ended up a little closer to what the timber beasts wanted, unfortunately, because it didn't deal all that much with roads. It still allowed roads within those stream areas, new roads to be built. But it didn't allow logging within there for the most part. That decision was made in an environmental assessment, and it affected all the forest plans, all the Bureau of Land Management resource management plans throughout the Pacific Northwest, where there are salmon and steelhead. And a similar amendment was made for bull trout, to protect bull trout, a little bit later. They call these two programs pack fish for the fish that go to the ocean, and infish for the bull trout and other species. But essentially, they're the same protections for this part of the world. Well, these forest plans get rid of those protections, those standards, those guidelines. They don't implement them. They get rid of them and they adopt some other fuzzy sort of language. Again, since they don't make decisions and don't have standards anymore, they're not enforceable, and they used to be. And the reason that was developed was to protect these species that are now listed under the Endangered Species Act. So that's a major change that will occur if the new regulations on the Bush administration stay in effect and forest plans become rather meaningless, wishy-washy documents.
Couple questions, Gary. If you want to jump in, go right ahead.
It just strikes me as amazing, first of all, that it isn't up to these loggers and the forestry companies to actually perform the environmental analysis themselves to prove that what they're doing is not going to harm the forest. It seems odd that your tax dollars are going to prove that it's okay for these people to cut down the trees. It seems very strange. Another thing, just a quick glance at this article, it's very telling in that the forest product... Ellen Engsted of the Montana Wood Products Association, she has a quote in here saying that the new rule is a common sense approach to planning that allows the agency to focus its efforts on actual on-the-ground projects. And then later on in the article, right here we've got a quote from Ms. Kimball, who uses the same words. It's very interesting. She says, we wanted to be able to build a plan that was more adaptable to changing conditions on the ground level. So when you get the person in the agency and the person in charge of the Wood Products Association using the same quote in the same article, and then environmental groups are just kind of passed off on the side saying they're unhappy, it kind of shows you where the collusion is. And these agencies are supposed to be separate from commercial ventures, and that's obviously not the case. But one thing that gives me a lot of hope is that there is already, and it made it all the way into the newspaper article here, there's already controversy. There's already people that are in the government that are opposing this, which gives me a sense of feeling that there's somebody to join with who's already in the mix and that is against it, and they're prominent Democrats, and maybe there's a way to get some common sense brought back into this. Not many people want to be on the Bush boat right now. So there's a lot of backpedaling in Washington right now. It seems like a really good time to push momentum into some rational forest planning.
A couple questions.
Great
real quick.
Comment.
Yeah, she's a sinking, that's for sure.
glug, glug.
How
glug,
does this
glug,
affect
glug.
Public participation?
Well, what this does, they do have a public involvement period, but because the plans don't make decisions, this quote, or even have standards or guidelines, I think the public involvement becomes perhaps less intense. You don't have... and the public is also not given any alternatives to look at. That's one of the major components of the NEPA, or the National Environmental Policy Act, is to look at options and alternatives. And in the past, different entities, it could be the wood products industry, it could be an environmental group, could make a recommendation to the Forest Service and say, look, this is what we think the plan should do for this national forest, say, for example, the Clearwater and Nez Perce National Forests. In the past, that was allowed. Currently, that is not allowed. And in fact, we're not going to be able to look at various options and the impacts on the environment. So the public, again, doesn't have that opportunity to look at various courses of action because only one alternative is presented, and that's the one the Forest Service wants. And this is particularly telling when you look at the roadless areas and recommendations for wilderness from the agency. There will only be one alternative out there, and that's it.
Now, where does this fit in with this newfangled trend we're seeing called collaboration?
Well, that is very interesting. That is mentioned in the regulations, although it's not defined, what we call collaboration. And you know, working with other folks is generally, you know, getting along is generally a good thing. But the problem is we already have a process for making decisions on public lands. And it's sort of like saying, if I were to go with some other citizens, say, look, you know, the voting process is really not that good, and you know, it's too cumbersome, too expensive. So how about you come over to my place on Friday night? We might have a few beers or a few things to drink. You know, have a good time. And those of you that want to vote, and then we'll make our own government here, so to speak. It's what it's doing is it is trying to hijack the legitimate process through an illegitimate process and try to make decisions in a de facto sense and put pressure. And so I think that's one of the problems is, first of all, collaboration isn't well defined. Secondly, how does it fit into the current process? Right now, any citizen can write a letter to the Forest Service on, let's say, under the old rules. That citizen could look at various alternatives and see kind of what the impacts were and then respond accordingly to the agency and voice their opinion. Right, but collaboration, by definition, involves a smaller group of people that get together and intensely discuss an issue, and it excludes many citizens, and a lot of times only people that are employed, let's say, by certain corporate interests. What products industry, for example, can participate very heavily in this process, or, you know, for that matter, conservation groups who don't tend to have the budgets that the wood products industry does, so they might not be able to attend the meeting all the time. So it tends to isolate citizen involvement and prohibit it. And especially if you live far away, how do you attend the meeting? You know, that's, you know, if I were to declare my hypothetical meeting and say, no, it's not just the county election I'm concerned about, it's a national election here. By the way, if you want to vote for the new, quote, president, you better come to my house out in the sticks of Idaho. I mean, that does not, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to do it that way from a public involvement or a democratic standpoint. Certainly, it's trying to come up with solutions, but I think democracy and getting the input from everybody is crucial, and collaboration can, doesn't have to, but it can shortchange that process.
So, in addition to the obvious reasons that the Forest Service would like to do this new forest planning, the obvious reason to me being to avoid being ruled against in court for breaking environmental regulations and standards, there seems to be a perception out there that the length of time it takes to get a project through should be decreased. And I think a lot of folks in the general public have a misconception from the popular press that this lengthy public involvement process and project development process is for some reason a bad thing.
And I don't think it's, you know, it's looking before you leap. It's trying to involve the public. It's part of the democratic process I mentioned before. And these other processes, when you try to shortchange that, collaboration may be in and of itself be a good thing, but what it's doing, if it replaces either in reality or even in a perceptual sense the democratic public process, and if it is the one that in effect makes the decisions, then it no longer is the same process that we had, and it's not the legally mandated process. So it you know, that's one of the concerns that I have, is again circumventing the process we do have. And the reason we have these laws, and does that mean they don't need to be tweaked or looked at? No, but you know, the time frames involved, they try to give citizens the opportunity to read environmental documents or government documents and have the access to all and to participate.
I was going to say the process ought to take as long as it takes to replace whatever was damaged, and if it was a bad idea. You know, these trees are not going to grow back in 5, 10, or 50 years even. This is hundreds and hundreds of years of a multiplicity of species working together, growing together to create what's called a biome. That cannot be replaced with any crackerjack box full of science. It's just not going to happen, no matter how hard they try. You can't genetically engineer old-growth forest. So to have a short-circuited route to destroy it and no provisions to replace it or preserve it seems ludicrous and against the interest of the public in having public lands in the first place.
You're listening to Wild Clearwater Country. We're going to keep talking about new forest planning regs and get into some more news as well when we come back. Thanks for listening. You're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country. This is KRFP Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 on your FM dial. Back into some more news. Okay. Briefly, from today's news, Associated Press. Interesting piece. Scientists hope mussels lend clues into Northwest salmon. This is out of Salem, Oregon. Most people know that tree rings tell stories about the age of the tree, the history of rainfall or drought in an area. But growth increments on Pacific Northwest river mussels, some of which are as old as 50 years, can also tell the tales of the water quality of the streams and the creeks where they live. There's a ton of information in here, researcher Jason Dunham said about the mussel shells. It is basically a stream of data. We just have to figure out what it is telling us. Scientists are hoping to unlock a decades-long accurate record of the health of aquatic areas. Consistent information about temperature, for example, is only known for about a handful of sites in Oregon and only for as long as 20 years. Researchers are hoping that freshwater mussels can fill in the gaps, providing historical data from periods before any water sampling was done. And Dunham, along with some other scientists, have collected about 450 mussels thus far for the U.S. Geological Survey in Corvallis, including areas in Oregon and as well as into central Idaho. Certification of Weyerhaeuser in Plum Creek draws fire. Environmental groups challenge green designation of forest practices of timber companies. This is out of the Lewiston Tribune, also an Associated Press article. Conservation groups are moving beyond the courtroom into the marketplace to pressure two of the nation's largest timber companies to green up their acts on private forest lands and challenge the timber industry's sustainable forestry standard. In separate actions, the Seattle Audubon Society and the Natural Resources Council of Maine are challenging green labels held by Weyerhaeuser and Plum Creek Timber Company that certifies their forests are managed in environmentally sustainable ways. And this is what they call greenwashing. We've talked about quite a bit on this show before, a favorite topic of the Trout when he was here with us. Weyerhaeuser and Plum Creek have denied, of course, violating their certifications. And the American Forest and Paper Association created this Sustainable Forestry Initiative in 94, so it's a timber industry-created standard. The Forest Stewardship Council standard, which was created in Bonn, Germany in 93 after the Earth Summit in Rio, is the one favored by conservation groups. So no surprise here that greenwashing being done by these massive national timber companies. And lastly, before we get into our weekly segment of Peak of the Week, let's talk a little bit about wolves.
Oh, boy. Well, big news coming up. We mentioned a little bit earlier that wolves are going to be delisted, according to the federal government. They want to delist them from the Endangered Species Act here in Idaho. They want to jump through those hoops. They want to begin that process soon. There will be public involvement, but they said maybe 30 days is all the public will have to look at all the documents. And they're just kicking that off soon, so we should be hearing something soon. I do know there's several people that are trying to rally against wolves, and there's a lot of people that are rallying for wolves.
That's right.
You could say that. And these folks, one of the things that the folks I think that have on their side, they're rallying more or less for the wolves, I think they have a lot of the science. When you look at the information, although science doesn't make, quote, decisions, it provides a good background from which sound decisions can be made. And when you look at the science, it does not show that wolves are the main factor in ungulate declines. So, and ungulates being elk, deer, moose. So
Cattle included. Very small portion of cattle losses are
right.
Attributed to predators.
Very, very, very small. So I think that's one needs to look at those facts. And one of the best places to get some of that facts, right here in Moscow. Well, there's the University of Idaho over here, and there are some excellent scientists there. Perhaps one of the most noted biologists, wildlife biologists in the entire world that studies ungulates is at the University of Idaho. He's he's, I guess, partially retired. He's trying to fully retire, Dr. Jim Peek, who we talked about here on the show before, and maybe we're going to have him on the program at some point in time. But I do know that he's probably going to be talking a little bit about elk and wolves to the legislature, the state legislature, to one of the committees next in the next couple weeks. And I believe he's also, and you'll hear more about it on this show, he's going to give a presentation to open the public to that's going to be sponsored by several citizen organizations. So here in February, I believe, Will, we're...
That's right.
That thing is just being organized just today, so we'll have more information later on. But I think that some important information that he has, and some very fascinating information, and he looks at the data, and he can tell a story and explain it to people in a way that's very understandable and makes sense.
Delisting has a couple problems right now as part of the listing process. Management proposals had to be drafted by the states involved, Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho, and it was decided that delisting would occur from all three states at the same time when management plans that were acceptable were in place. Montana and Idaho's have been accepted, even though Idaho's is really poor. Wyoming's has not, and it continues to be the rogue state in this. But unfortunately, the Fish and Wildlife Service has done a 180, possibly because their new boss is the former governor of Idaho, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if Dirk Kempthorne could have some influence.
They are cooperating and are now trying to delist state by state, or at least Idaho and Montana separately from Wyoming. They're going ahead with this, even though they're backpedaling and breaking their own guidelines.
Yeah, basically what they promised the American citizens, the process that was promised to us as citizens, is not being followed. The commitments that were made are being broken. And that's the legacy in this proposal, and I think we need to look at that as well as look at the on-the-ground effects of wolves.
And I think folks who care about wild critters and wild places really need to get on the horn here, because this state is going to slaughter wolves once they have the chance,
right,
and it's not going to be pretty. And so we really need to make some statements here. And if you have a pen and you like to write, just write your paper, write your local reg, write your elected officials. Because they're going to manage black bears. To quote Idaho Governor Jim Risch, it's kind of a telling quote. They will be managed just as cats and black bears, which are treated very poorly. Cougars are probably the least respected animal in the West, and definitely in the state of Idaho. There are virtually no regulations concerning cougar hunting at all.
I think one of the things, Will, that is very fascinating of what Dr. Peek, I think, will be presenting to the legislature is when he looks at what the effects are of killing predators in the backcountry, especially wolves, which all the data shows tend to select for the weak and the oldest animals. They tend to make a herd healthier in a demographic or age spread sense. And I guess population folks call that demographics being the word. So it's fascinating, and I think killing wolves in the backcountry, in the wilderness and all these big roadless areas, may have just the opposite effect of what they want to happen in terms of herd health. Speaking of elk herds mainly, but also deer and perhaps moose. So.
Yeah, there's some interesting data out there now from this past hunting season, and hunter success actually went up in all of those units where Fish and Game had proposed to kill wolves to improve elk success.
Mm-hmm. So the percent success went up in that's very interesting, Will.
Yeah, and some other interesting data out there shows that You know, elk herds have been in decline for quite some time, and this is not not a factor that or not a their population dynamics have not been significantly impacted by the introduction of wolves, and folks have known that for quite some time.
Well, we get about down to the time for our little peek.
Yeah, I think it's time for
presentation. All right. Well, we'll have to have a little drum roll for the peek as well as for when we give the whopper. This week we're going to have a peek. And since we talked a little bit about Meadow Creek, the clear water there, I thought we'd talk about perhaps the most prominent. And I use the term prominent not in terms of the most steep or the pointiest or the most serrated, because this peak is not that at all. But what I mean by prominent in this case is massive. It's just a large. It covers a lot of area. And it's very prominent in and around Elk City. It overlooks sort of two watersheds, the Meadow Creek watershed, which is to its east mainly, and it overlooks the American River watershed, which is to its west. And this mountain is one that used to have a lookout on it. I don't believe the lookout is manned anymore. Or personed, I guess, in politically correct parlance of today, Will. And it's a nice hike to get up there. Unfortunately, though, the trails around it are open. Some of them are open to motor vehicles, so you do see a lot of motorized use. It's not necessarily a quiet hike to get up there or a quiet horseback ride. It's a big, round mountain that just stands out. Just about anywhere you are, you can. It's prominent from just about any place on the Clearwater Salmon River Divide. Any of those mountains we've talked about, a few of them in the past. You look up and see this. It's not really high, but just a big brown, massive mountain with trees on it, and also some open places. So, Will, our peak of the week stands at 6,847 feet in elevation, according to the map produced by the Nez Perce National Forest for the public. So that's over 2,000 meters in elevation. And it goes by the name of Anderson Butte. Famous spot, a very prominent place. And a lot of people go up there and hike around. And from there, you can overlook some of the wild country to the east, the Meadow Creek roadless area, and also some of the Meadow Creek roadless areas to the south as well in some of the upper Kirk's Fork, which is a tributary to the American River, one of the tributaries before it becomes the South Fork of the Clearwater after it joins the Red River. So Anderson Butte is our peak of the week, a big, prominent, big old round massive mountain. I always have a warm feeling when I see it. Well, it's amazing. You just looking at that thing. I've been all the way down to Boston Mountain, down there, which is in the Salmon River drainage. Although you can look north from there into the headwaters of Meadow Creek, and you see this big roundy sitting out there to the northwest. And it's like I said, it's not particularly high, but it's just a big massive block of a mountain. Always going to be a warm feeling to see. It's kind of it's almost like, you know, feeling at home. It's very recognizable, I think, just by its round shape. It's got kind of a little distinctive look to it, and it's not just a big mound, although it's got its own distinctive qualities. So, Anderson Butte.
Well, that brings us to our next segment. We're going to do back-to-back drum rolls here.
All right.
We're going to get into the Whopper of the Week.
Okay.
And,
here we go.
We're starting this tale outside of the wild Clearwater country, but we're hoping to bring it back into this part of the world. Just to illustrate a couple of interesting points here. This week's Whopper comes from a spokesman for Weyerhaeuser Paper Company, Frank Mendizabal. Frank was recently quoted in talking about the certification of Weyerhaeuser and Plum Creek for having green designations for their forest practices, which are now being brought into question. He said that we have not harmed any owls or done any work in habitat or reduced habitat for spotted owls or any other threatened or endangered species. He said that right after it was explained that many logging projects will log right up to the tree that a spotted owl nests in, but not log that tree. And he still claims that the work his company does not affect the habitat or the owl itself.
Wow.
If that's not a disconnect, I don't know what is.
Okay, so the owl has to live in just one tree where it's nest and find all its food just right on that tree.
Where it nests has become its habitat, apparently.
That's it.
According to Ecology by Frank.
Wow.
So
never mind the large foraging, what they call foraging areas in terms of predator sort of prey relationships. I think a lot of the raptors and owls, foraging is a term that's been used to apply to goshawks and I guess to spotted owls
mm-hmm.
as well. They have fairly large areas, much larger than their nest sites.
Yeah.
And even protecting of nest sites I'm drawing some analogies here. They may not be perfect from a scientific perspective, but goshawks, the federal agencies have certain guidelines. They don't always follow them because they are guidelines and not required standards. But to protect, sometimes 10 acres, sometimes 40 acres surrounding that nest tree. Right up to the tree.
Right
wow.
up to the tree. Yeah. So this disconnect between an animal and its the ecosystem, an organism in the ecosystem it inhabits, I don't think Frank would like it if we decided to tear down his house except for his bedroom where he was sleeping.
Yeah.
So this week's Whopper to Frank Mendizabal of Weyerhaeuser,
wow.
who needs a lesson or two in ecology.
There we go. Well, that's a great Whopper. Well, it's just getting to be about that time for us to wrap up. Well, next week, a little bit of talk more about some wolves.
Yeah, I'm hoping to have a couple special guests on here.
A couple of guests, because it will be a fairly big news week.
It will.
For the four-legged canid, the big wild dog of North America.
It will. If you're listening in streaming audio and happen to be in the southern part of the state, or if you're up here locally and are going to be in the Boise area next week, a group that hates wolves is having a rally at the State House
mm-hmm.
to hurry up and delist them so we can start hunting them. And, folks that care about wolves need to show up down there at the State House and voice their concern. So if you... If you need more information, you can get a hold of a myriad of different groups, Friends of the Clearwater, the Wolf Education Research Center in Winchester, or Defenders of Wildlife.
And they have a number down in Boise, I believe, and all
yeah,
of us there.
That's right.
All right. So we'll be talking about wolves next week. Well, I guess we're just about ready to go into our next news program. Between the Lines, you're listening to KRFP Moscow, Idaho. This is home to Radio Free Moscow, and it's your community radio station. So if you're interested, I'm sure you could come down and learn how to become a disc jockey and go on the air, have a talk show, a music show, or just about whatever. It's a free format. And that's very positive. There's a small music library down here, so there's a lot of things to choose from. So I'd encourage everybody to support community radio. We're starting a brand new year here, and community radio needs as much support as possible. So in terms of labor, help, and financial support, so KRFP Moscow would certainly appreciate any support you can give. And that's a plug here for the community radio station.